You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. We're here with you from 4 to 5 every weekday now, having moved a couple of weeks ago from our former noontime slot. And on the program today, we have a returning friend here for the University of Illinois. He was on faculty in the School of Music for quite some years. Is now professor of music at the University of York in England. His name, William Brooks, composer, musicologist, and something of a student of the poetry of William Butler Yeats, and particularly an aspect of his recreation of his own poetry. And he's going to be presenting some of what he has discovered about Yeats in a MillerCom lecture on the University of Illinois campus Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's called Everlasting Voices, Yeats Chanting and Music. Be happening at 4 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum. And he's also going to be having a composition of his performed by the group formerly known as the New Music Ensemble at the University of Illinois, now called the Illinois Modern Ensemble. And that concert being given at 7:30, number of different pieces on that program, including Bill Brooks's piece that will be played by the duo who he has brought along with him. They are collectively called Soundweave, and we'll be introducing them to you in just a little bit. But first, welcome back to school, Bill.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Back to your former digs. And you show up here every once in a while. I see you every once in a while.
I'm back more than I'm away sometimes, it seems.
What made you leave?
Oh, combination of circumstances, really. It didn't have anything to do with discontent with the school. This is still one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, you keep coming back. And now, what is it exactly that you're teaching at the University of York?
Well, that varies, actually. It's a very flexible department, and it's a relatively small department compared to the University of Illinois. So we all wear many hats. This fall, I'm running a large project, which is two modules and a kind of an administrative load associated with the John Cage centenary. We're doing a big festival called Getting Nowhere on the 14th to the 17th of November. And there's a website for that if anyone's interested. www.gettingnowhere.org. Go to org, because if you go to com, you find a bicycle shop. But it's a big festival with a lot of music being done. And anyway, that's my teaching load for the fall. That's quite enough, thank you.
Well, I imagine that it is a lot. That is, there's a lot of appeal to being able to have a certain amount of flexibility, and change what you're teaching from semester to semester, if they do semesters or some other system there.
It's three terms a year, but it's very like a semester system in its administrative structure. And yes, indeed, it is very nice to be able to venture into new areas, sometimes to revisit old ones that I've had to leave fallow for a while. So, yeah.
So for somebody for whom John Cage has been a particular study and other early experimental composers, how did you end up getting involved in the poetry of Yeats?
Well, I have to thank Paul Rowe, basically, of Soundweave, for challenging me with the task of creating a piece on Irish topics for the duo. And almost coincidentally, but not quite, at the same time that I had the first couple of emails from Paul, Roger Marsh left for me a copy, just a photostat copy, of Yeats's essay Speaking to the Psaltery, which I'd been interested in a very offhand way for a year or two. Can't remember how I first came across it, and he said, "Oh, I have a copy, and I'll leave it for you." And then nothing happened, but eventually it showed up in my pigeonhole, and bang, the two fit together like hand in glove, and suddenly I had a topic and a notion for the piece, and I had a lot of reading to do and a lot of homework to do, all of which appealed to me immensely. Fortunately, I found out that nearly all the homework had been done a few years before by a man named Ronald Shuchard, professor at, I think, Emory in Georgia, who wrote a magnificent book called The Last Minstrels, which traced nearly all of the chronological data and information about Yeats's engagement with this project. And so that sort of solved the whole gathering data problem. Then the problem became, or the problem that was interesting to me, which bore immediately on the piece, was can we reconstruct these experiments? Can we do something to bring Yeats's notion alive rather than having it simply be a historical narrative? So that's what the piece is about, in a sense, and that's certainly what was animating my investigation of the ideas and the practices that characterized Yeats and his associates at the turn of the century.
The piece, the composition of yours called Everlasting Voices.
Yes, that's right. It's very confusing. It's my fault, but the lecture and the composition both have the same title.
That's what I'm here for. I try to clarify.
I appreciate that.
As much for my own understanding as for our listeners, and I hope the two will coincide at some point. So you use the term psaltery, and I know for the longest time in various hymns and carols and so on, there'd be reference to the psaltery and harp, and I'm thinking, oh, that's people singing psalms. But that's psalmody. Psaltery is something else altogether different.
Well, the psaltery came along a little bit after Yeats started the practice of chanting his poetry, and when he began working with an actress, a very important person in his life, and I think unduly neglected by history, an actress named Florence Farr, who also chanted texts. And in the course of all of this, they began to write down the pitches that they seemed to be speaking their texts on. And then because Yeats had the idea that in ancient Ireland, the bardic poets declaimed to multitudes accompanied only by a lyre or lute or some sort of stringed instrument, he decided he needed a stringed instrument. And he got the early music pioneer, Arnold Dolmetsch, who is an unlikely collaborator but nevertheless was quite a good one and a lifelong friend, actually, to build him a psaltery, so-called, which was really a kind of very compact harp-like device. It had about 15 to 20 strings. There were various versions and various sizes built, which could be each tuned individually. The most elaborate versions included the full chromatic scale and also quarter tones, because he found out that he wasn't necessarily chanting in ordinary equal temperament and he needed some extra notes. So all of that began to be used by he and by Florence Farr in their readings and in their public performances, hence chanting to the psaltery, speaking to the psaltery.
Yeah, coming back to the instrument itself, if I remember, I'm imagining that this instrument, I'm not sure if I've actually seen a picture of a psaltery, I may have, but you will see, virtually everybody has seen paintings of a cherub, you know, a flying cherub, playing some tiny little harp-like thing, very tiny little thing. Or people may have seen pictures of eventually King David, the guy who became King David and is the writer of Psalms, playing something like that as well. I'm imagining that is either a lyre and or a psaltery.
Yeah, I think that's more lyre than psaltery, at least in late Yeats's universe. Actually, the instrument that most resembles the psaltery, if we go to a kind of colloquial understanding of instruments, is the autoharp.
Really?
And which is a psaltery with buttons, basically. And in fact, since I don't have access to a psaltery, there are only about three or four that survive of Yeats's instruments, and they're safely behind glass in various museums. In our performances, we're using an autoharp as a substitute psaltery, as it were. I must say that, as a disclaimer, that I'm not literally trying to reproduce Yeats's practices in this composition, Everlasting Voices. Among other things, it has pre-recorded music that he couldn't possibly have heard or even imagined. But I wanted to take them as a starting point for a new work that would capture some of the essence. So the autoharp does the job very well, I think.
Since you use the term now, and of course in the title of this of your lecture, chanting, which is, he would have spelled it differently and pronounced it differently, I suppose.
He started out, I have to say, that's more a hook for the audience than a fair account, because he retained that spelling and the kind of broad pronunciation chaunting only for the first 5 or 6 years. And in later writings, he dropped the U. C-H-A-U-N-T is what he originally wrote. In later writings, he dropped the U, didn't feel necessary perhaps to don that particular piece of artifice. But it's a nice engagement, and it gets you a little bit away from thinking about Anglican chant or other Buddhist chant or something like that that might come to mind, but actually has very little to do with what he was doing.
Or plain chant or anything like that.
Yeah, or so, plain chant. Yeah.
I'm sure everybody's heard the stereotypical way of reading a poem that tends to be very bland, and I've never understood this personally myself, why a poet gets up and speaks his or her poetry with this flat deadpan thing. What's the difference between doing that, declaiming a poetry, a poem, and chanting the poem?
Well, what you describe as a kind of deadpan delivery might, in fact, be termed, under some circumstances, chanting the poem.
So I might have Yeats to blame for that?
You might have Yeats to blame for that, indeed.
Noodle's got the thumbs up here.
Yeah, that's quite right. he had quite an influence among younger poets. You can come down as far as Allen Ginsberg and hear echoes of Yeats, I think. Normally, among other things, modern poets tend to carry lines forward, to enjam the lines, to have the delivery controlled by the syntax of the poem. Yeats was very much a line-by-line person, and with a kind of steady rhythm as well as a kind of intoned delivery. It's quite distinctive, his way of delivering. We don't have much direct evidence. He only made recordings very late in his life as part of broadcasts for the BBC. There were no recordings of Florence Farr. We have no recordings of the psaltery actually being in use. So a lot of it is anecdotal accounts, descriptive accounts, and the notation that Farr and Yeats and Dolmetsch, for that matter, developed to set down in written form the practice as it was applied to particular sections of verse.
But I think you did bring along a sample.
Indeed.
Of William Butler Yeats. And Mike, if you haven't already, is the first track on the CD that you have there. Mike Pritchard is our sound engineer and gets to play these things as well. Anything to be said about it other than, do we know what poem it is?
Yes. This is a very famous poem of Yeats that he was constantly asked to recite, called The Lake Isle of Innisfree. And you'll hear immediately, it's a very crackly old recording. It was recorded for broadcast for the BBC in Ireland in 1932. So there's a lot of static and a lot of noise. But you can hear very clearly, I think, the way he intones the verse and the sense of melody and rhythm that he applies to it.
William Butler Yeats reading his own poetry here on Live and Local.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the crickets sing. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray. I hear it in the deep heart's core.
The poet William Butler Yeats reading his own poem, The Lake Isle at Innisfree. And, you know, as I was listening to that, it actually seemed to me that his sound, this chanting, had less to do with that image, the stereotypical image that I imagined of the poet reading his or her poems, than it does with certain English actors. Laurence Olivier, for example, Ralph Richardson, maybe a lot of others of the older generation, their tone of voice, or actually Lionel Barrymore in A Christmas Carol, sort of reminds me almost more of that than of the other.
Well, Yeats is partly to blame for that as well, because, of course, he was very deeply involved in the theater, and he and Farr produced several plays right at the turn of the century, some by himself and some by others. Farr and her associates got interested in ancient Greek drama and began chanting translations of Sophocles and so forth. So there was a whole kind of quite widespread theatrical movement devoted to finding a mechanism and finding appropriate repertoire to apply these kinds of techniques. So there may be a Barrymore-Yeats connection for all I know. I wouldn't speculate too much about that.
Well, it lends a sort of mystery to the whole thing, to the mysterious tone, at least to my ear.
It does indeed, and that's yet another arrow in the quiver, so to speak, because Yeats, as we know, was a mystic. He and Farr, in their very earliest experiments, were at ceremonies conducted by the Order of the Golden Dawn, to which both of them belonged. So there was an explicitly mystical or explicitly spiritual component to this practice from a very early stage. That tended to disappear later around the turn of the century. But
the practice of chanting the poetry.
Yeah.
Chanting the poetry.
Yeah.
You have another excerpt here. Also Yeats reading. Now, you had just said that we don't have any examples of him reading with psaltery.
That's right. And so what I've done in this example, this is primarily for the lecture. I don't use this in the piece at all. But what I did for this example, I have a parallel instance from the piece, was to apply a psaltery by the means of technology, modern technology, which is my faithful autoharp, recorded and sampled. To this text, exactly what you've just heard, trying to do what I think maybe Farr and Yeats would have done with the psaltery when they performed their poems. We know quite a bit about how often a note was played from manuscripts that are left behind, and we know that the note that was played was always meant to be in tune with, or at the very least related to, the kind of pitch that was going on at the time. So this next instance is the same recording exactly, but with this autoharp / psaltery added in a possible reconstruction of what might have been heard.
So what we know of the notation, do we have written samples of the notation?
We do. We have quite a bit. We have over a dozen instances of poems that were, or texts that were written down, and inflections and pitches set above or alongside them.
Well, let's give a listen. Once again, it's Yeats reading same poem, the Lake Isle at Innisfree.
Of Innisfree.
Of Innisfree. I might get it right this third time through. With Bill Brooks' reimagining of the psaltery. In as accompaniment.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, For peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the crickets sing. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray. I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Well, I admit I would have expected more notes.
No, they were quite sparing in their use of the instrument. Farr would occasionally get more exuberant than Yeats, and a couple of the transcriptions of her own readings, not necessarily of Yeats' poems, but of other things, seem more florid. But basically, it was a very sparing accentuation that they applied.
So it lends pitch where you didn't necessarily know there was pitch.
Exactly.
Because between the first and the second, I hadn't really given it much thought. Yes, the voice goes up and down a little bit, but then it manages to have clear pitches as represented by, in this case, the autoharp or the psaltery. We're talking here on Live and Local with William Brooks of the University of York in England, formerly of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He is in town with two colleagues from Ireland, actually, to give a Millercom lecture Wednesday afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus in Urbana on South Gregory Street. The lecture called Everlasting Voices, Yeats Chanting in Music, and Everlasting Voices also is the name of Bill Brooks' composition written for his guests, the Irish duo Soundweave, and they will be performing that as part of the concert by the I have to look up again what's the name of the ensemble. It used to be called the New Music Ensemble at the University of Illinois. Illinois Modern Ensemble?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Something
yeah.
like that. It's buried on a piece of paper here right in front of me, and I will dig it up in a little bit. That concert will be on Thursday night. And I know you brought along a short excerpt of the composition, Everlasting Voices. Does this involve the two performers who are with us today?
No, this is a kind of an interlude for recorded media alone. What I did, I mean, there are many components to this piece, and I could go on at length, but I won't. Yeats' texts I had recorded by an English actor named Dennis Dennehy, very beautifully recorded. I didn't give him any instructions except to listen to the extant Yeats recordings, really, and then went over with a sound engineer to Dublin, and we sat down and in an afternoon recorded many segments. And in this particular one, he is reading the section from the autobiographies in which Yeats described meeting Maud Gonne, the love of his life, the unrequited love of his life, really. Very long, very famous literary romance. She was an Irish nationalist, quite an extraordinary woman in her own right, really remarkable. And so in this, Dennis is reading the Yeats text that describes this encounter, but I've treated it as one might a poem to a certain extent. So as in the example you just heard, you'll hear an autoharpy-like sound picking out pitches from Dennis's reading. You'll also hear some ancillary voices. I also have lots and lots of voices in this piece, kind of commenting on the text as it flows along. That's really all there is to say about it.
A short excerpt from Everlasting Voices by William Brooks on Live and Local.
I was 23 when the troubling of my life began.
Be no more.
Be no more.
A hansom drove up to our door with Miss Maud Gonne.
Flame under flame
under flame.
I had never thought to see in a living woman so great beauty. It belonged to famous pictures, to poetry, to some legendary past.
Time be no more.
She spoke to me of her wish for a play that she could act in Dublin. I offered to write for her the play I have called The Countess Catlin. She spoke of her desire for power and vexed my father by praise of war, as if there were some virtue in excitement itself.
Go, Rockdale!
Be no more!
We were seeking different things. She, some memorable action, and I but to discover and communicate the state of being.
A short excerpt from Everlasting Voices by William Brooks, with the various performers involved. There, the piece will be played on Thursday at 7:30 in a concert by the Illinois Modern Ensemble, including performance by our guests, who we are going to introduce in just a moment, after I tell you that our program today on Live and Local is made possible with support from the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner. So the piece, I imagine, will be perhaps best experienced by those who do go to the lecture, because they'll get, or at least ideally experienced, because they'll have the full background to, well, sort of like we just got, you know.
That's
the,
right.
The progression of Yeats reading to Yeats accompanied to, I mean, it almost sounded like you were going to pick right up with that poem that we heard at first, and then, of course, it goes off in other directions, and it was fascinating to me. The lecture Bill Brooks is going to give will be Wednesday afternoon, 4 o'clock, Everlasting Voices, Yeats Chanting and Music, and then the concert at the Krannert Center, with other pieces as well on that program Thursday night. And according to the extract of your or abstract of your talk, make reference to, as you mentioned earlier, Irish minstrels, also a certain look back to ancient Greece. And we have sort of two Irish minstrels right here of a different ilk, I suppose. Together they are Soundweave, and individually they are Paul Rowe on the clarinet, you mentioned earlier, Bill, as the person who sort of instigated this whole project. And then Nuala Hayes, actor and storyteller. How on earth did you guys decide that there's a duo here somehow?
I suppose I should take that one, Kevin.
Go right ahead.
So I've been always intrigued by collaboration. And I've worked a lot as a musician with composers, and I find it continues to expand my own imagination and creativity by working with other people. And about 6 years ago, Tom Johnson visited Dublin, and we had a day of Tom Johnson, the American composer who lives in Paris, playing his music. And I played one of his seminal pieces called Bedtime Stories, which is for clarinet and narrator, but the one person does both. They play the clarinet and then narrate the stories. And at the time I met the composer and really hit it off with him. And I enjoyed his quirky take on music and, I suppose, words and on life. And in preparing the performance myself, I listened to other recordings. And I heard an English player playing it, and the work sounds so different to the way I played it, because when I speak, I've got a totally different accent. So that's when I got the idea. It might be really interesting to put this piece together with the Irish language. And that was the kind of the starting point for a project which then became a radio documentary. And along the way, I realised very soon, strange thing to say, that I would not be able to recite it myself in the Irish language, because I wouldn't be sufficiently fluent in the language or sufficiently conversant in the language to do the work. And so this is where Nuala came into the loop to be the one who would speak the parts. And like with a lot of collaborative work that I've done, is if you set out with an open mind and an open imagination, it's amazing what you can learn along the way. And for me, I learned a lot about translation itself from English into the Irish language, and I learned a lot about my own language. And actually, it was funny because I was touching base with my own cultural roots in a sense. And throughout this project, I've been it's been an enormously interesting experience, say, working with Nuala, both in terms of her being an actor, but also her clear understanding of the cultural context of the language and so forth. So that's how we got together at that point. During the course of that also, I had commissioned Bill to write a piece, and the agenda with Bill was very open again, like good collaborative practice is no kind of setting the boundaries too strictly. And I'm absolutely entranced that Bill has put in so much time to come up with such a fantastic work for us to do, and we're really looking forward to performing it in the next couple of days.
So. To performing Everlasting Voices. Uh-huh. So obviously, as a duo, you grew beyond just doing this one piece.
Sure.
Or you would probably get extremely bored with your work.
Exactly. Yeah, we had a few other pieces. We had some stories from Tim Burton, which...
Tim Burton, the film director.
Yeah, which the Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy is a book of shorts. What is it? Poem? Not poem.
Melancholy Death of what?
Oyster Boy.
Okay.
It's a heard of it.
No, I have not.
Anyway, it's a great book, and it's another piece that was written a number of years ago for bass clarinet and narrator, with the one person doing it again. And so we transferred that into our repertoire as well. We also commissioned a couple of other pieces, which just to widen out the repertoire. And again, we're kind of open to where this might take us. We're not sure where it's going to go. Even when we're going to meet some composers tomorrow evening, and I dare say maybe some of the composers there will be very enthused, intrigued, and they may decide, hey, I'd like to really write for this group. And of course, we're very interested in new work. You know?
And Nuala, what's your musical experience before this?
I'm sorry to say, very, very little. I learned the piano when I was a little girl, but... very, very little. I have worked with musicians as a storyteller. I've worked with musicians, but very often the story is leading and the telling of the story leads. I've worked with some very creative musicians who improvise along with the story, or in varying ways might compose along with it, but it's been narrative led. So this is a great challenge for me, because I have to work with already composed work and work with stories. The Tom Johnson piece is actually called Bedtime Stories, but in fact it's very carefully written to a rhythm. So in a way this is forcing me into a structure that I wasn't really familiar with, so it's wonderfully challenging. And I've also learned a huge amount from just listening to Bill's experimentation as well, because I was also very familiar with the attitude to Yeats and chanting, and there was a degree of dismissal of it, but Bill's research has awakened something very much. So that's really a long answer to your short question.
And where does the dismissal come from?
This is just my view. I think Yeats was a genuine experimenter. Very often people who are experimenting aren't at the same place that audiences are. And his ideas of poetry and of theatre were actually make sense now in a way that they didn't make sense to people at the time. And there was always this conflict between pleasing the audience and pleasing the box office and creating something new. And the theatre in Ireland moved on and moved away from that kind of experimentation and has moved into pleasing larger numbers in the world. I think this is just my personal view.
I wonder if then the notion of an experimenting poet and declaimer of his poetry meshes particularly well with an experimenting composer, which you may not still think of yourself as, but many listeners who I'm sure listening to this program will think, well, I can hear he's doing an experiment of some kind.
I don't mind. I'm happy to be put in the experimental box if it includes Mr. Yeats with me. That's very good ship's company, I think.
Well, speaking of experimentation, this piece of Tom Johnson that brought this duo together, Soundweave, we have a few examples of, including both the English original and one of the Irish. And is it just bizarre coincidence that it was translated by somebody named Ray, do you say it, Yeats?
Yes.
The same way?
Same Ray Yeats, but he puts an E into his
Yeats. I see that. Y-E-A-T-E-S. But nice little coincidence for the purpose of this discussion. Any further introduction required other than that these are some bedtime stories?
They've been translated into German and into French. And I suppose what I might say, from my own point of view, my initial idea behind having the pieces in the Irish language was actually a musical sense of things. Because to me, as a musical piece, the voice and the instrument go together. And I wasn't necessarily focusing in on the words. But of course, then once we got into translating the words and trying to match, get a good translation from the English to the Irish, it led to all sorts of interesting challenges for the translator, Ray Yeats, that you mentioned. And there was great discussions between Newell and Ray about the correct word for correct Irish words for various English words, such as Chinese puzzle, which is one of the phrases that Tom Johnson words that he uses in it. And but for me, that wasn't the important thing. It was the sound of it. Of course, when I met Tom, we met Tom in Paris, and he was very insistent on, you know, the words being so very, very important. So that has led us to a challenge, actually, as regards, people understanding it in the Irish language. So we're flexible. We do it in the Irish to give a sense of the music of Irish language, but also we do it in English in terms of the mediation and the understanding of it.
Well, just one more point of introduction. At least my introduction to this piece was on a YouTube video with other performers.
Sure.
And I think maybe possibly the English person that you mentioned. And it's kind of funny. The audience was having a grand time.
Sure, sure.
But I wondered aloud to you all as we were getting set up whether the visual was part of the humor, depending upon how the performers would treat that. And then one of the two of you said, "Well, Tom Johnson wasn't very happy with that notion."
Well, I just say I was as a performer and an actor, I was a little bit put out when I listened to the tape of the interview with Tom Johnson, who listened to my voice. They played me reading a little bit in Irish, and he just said in a very relaxed way, tell the actress not to try to make it too interesting. Boring is interesting.
Boring is good, isn't it?
Boring is good. Boring is interesting. He did say boring is interesting. So that left me in a bit of a dilemma. But, when you're telling a story, even a bedtime story, you put what you feel should be in it. So I do the best I can in the way I can. But just to say, we're going to start with the first story, which I think is the bedtime story, and we're going to do it in Irish. And basically, it's very simple. There's a man in bed with his wife, and he can't sleep. So he asks her to tell him a bedtime story, and she asks him to tell her a bedtime story. And they go, "You tell me one, or you tell me one." And then he says, I don't know any bedtime stories." And she says, "You tell me a story, you tell me a story, you tell me a story." At the end, she turns around to him and said, "Oh, be quiet and let me sleep."
So with appropriate performer's license, with the directive of the composer to be boring or not, here we go. It's Soundweave, who are Paul Rowe on the clarinet and Nuala Hayes speaking in music by Tom Johnson called Bedtime Stories. Four of the stories.
Thank you.
Bhí fear an uair a bhain agus fáib colata aige. Chas sé a bhain sa leaba agus dúirt ina scéal colata dom. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Agus dúirt sé sin ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé sin ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach sé sin níl scéal colata rólas agam. Smuinig tusa cheann domsa. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé sin ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé sin ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé sin ina tusa scéal colata domsa. Ach dúirt sé a bíod a chost agus legdom colla. Once upon a time, a woman and her husband decided to invite three other couples over for a dinner party. The couples were invited, the food was prepared, and everything seemed to be in order, except they couldn't decide how the eight people should be seated. At first, it seemed best to keep the couples together. Or perhaps in another arrangement. Or perhaps another way. But then they thought, no, it will be better to have the four men on one side of the table and the four women on the other. And then they thought, no, it will be better to mix everyone up. Man, woman, man, woman. Or woman, man, woman, man. Or maybe man, man, woman, woman. Or maybe woman, woman, man, man. But before they could really decide, their friends started arriving and everybody just took the first seats they came to. It worked out fine. One time, a composer tried to write a melody to go with a little story. The melody seemed too long, so he shortened it. This version still seemed too long, so he shortened it some more. This version still seemed too long, so he shortened it some more. This version seemed too short, so he lengthened it. This version still seemed too short, so he lengthened it some more. This version still seems too short, so he lengthened it some more. This version seemed similar to the first melody he had written to go with the little story. He thought to himself, this melody was really much better before I started changing it. Once upon a time, there was a businessman who followed the stock market. Every Sunday morning, he studied the newspaper and noted the direction the market had taken during the 5 days of that particular week. or four in the case of a holiday. After some weeks, he began to observe a distinct tendency for the prices to decline and became interested in buying. But he thought it would be smart to wait a little longer for the prices to go down some more. So every Sunday morning, he studied the market and waited for the prices to go down a little more. After some weeks, he began to observe that the prices weren't really going down anymore, and in fact were rising. So he decided he would buy without hesitating any longer. So 1 week later, he made a large purchase on the stock market, but apparently a number of other investors had made the same decision at the same time, because that Monday morning, the market reached an all-time high.
Seems like a rather self-analytical piece in the process of composition, or at least somebody's process of composition, among other things. That was clarinetist Paul Rowe with actor Nuala Hayes. Together they are the duo called Soundweave. That's the piece that brought them together. It's part of the piece that brought them together. Tom Johnson's Bedtime Stories, as Nuala said at the outset. The first one is the bedtime story and the rest are other stories, I guess. How many stories altogether?
It's 12 stories.
So about a 20-minute piece
or a little longer, like 24 minutes about, yeah.
And this will not be in any of the performances this week, or will it? Because you're in residency at different parts at the university, right?
We will play some of the stories at a composer's forum tomorrow, and we will play some more of them in the Irish language, actually, just to let people get the sound of the language. And we'll also play, I think, 6 of them on the programme on the Thursday night.
Oh, on the concert by... I have it in front of me, the Illinois Modern Ensemble. I have to look this up because this is the ensemble formerly known as, I want to say Prince, ensemble formerly known as the New Music Ensemble, University of Illinois New Music Ensemble. That concert will be Thursday night, 7:30 at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. Eduardo Diaz-Munoz and Stephen Andrew Taylor are co-artistic directors. There'll be compositions by some of the students on there, plus those pieces, some of the bedtime stories, and especially the work by William Brooks, who's my other guest on our program today, called Everlasting Voices, which comes directly out of the all the information you can glean from Bill when you go to his MillerCom lecture Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's called Everlasting Voices, Yeats, Chanting, and Music at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana on South Gregory Street. Is that an adequate summary of what's going on this week?
It's a good start, I tell you.
A bit of it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you all on here to hear about some things that I never had given any thought to whatsoever. And I'm glad that somebody did, and be fascinated to hear it all. I would think fascinated to hear this 25-minute composition, The Everlasting Voices, sort of grow out of this knowledge. Or I guess really went the other way around. You made the composition after learning a little bit, and then it sounds like you had to go learn a little bit more to probably present this lecture.
That's correct. I sort of had absorbed a lot in making the piece, but I hadn't really put it into any logical order. So I've been spending a lot of time in recent days trying to do exactly that.
If you're going to present a MillerCom lecture, they expect great things of you, I guess.
I hope I can satisfy.
I was just going to say that I think Bill has tapped into something extraordinary, because he has also focused in on the early plays of Yeats. And these were very significant plays, The Countess Kathleen and Kathleen Ni Houlihan. And they were plays that had a huge impact in both politics and the story of culture, particularly the culture of theatre in Ireland. And that and the relationship with Maud Gonne. And it started with the chanting, but it's actually quite a very substantial piece, I think, and is very, very exciting to be involved in.
And that, and you're talking about the composition.
Yes,
as
the
well
composition.
As
yes. The whole, yeah.
Well, it should be fascinating to hear both the lecture and the concert. Bill Brooks of the University of York, formerly of the University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign. And Soundweave collaborations this week. Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Our program today is supported by the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the series collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. On tomorrow's Live and Local, I'll be welcoming pianist Ian Hobson of the University of Illinois faculty. He has embarked this semester, actually this season, on collaborating with various other performers on the chamber music of Johannes Brahms, as well as doing some of Brahms' solo works. And the first of those concerts is happening later this week. We'll be talking about that on tomorrow's Live and Local, starting at 4 o'clock. Some other events you can go see and hear live in our listening area over the next couple of days. I don't have anything on my calendar today. Doesn't mean nothing is happening, but it just didn't make it to our calendar. Tomorrow, the Parkland Early Jazz Ensemble is performing at the Iron Post in Urbana, 7 o'clock in the evening. The Traditional Jazz Orchestra is at Bouvon's in Urbana tomorrow evening at 5:30. Laurie Bernard and John McMahon are at Clark Bar in Champaign tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. There's a faculty recital by tenor Justin Vickers at Illinois State University at the Center for the Performing Arts in Normal tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. For those of you who heard me mention Justin's recital last week at Illinois Wesleyan, it's the same recital. If you missed that, he's doing it at ISU tomorrow night. And, the program of Brahms Instrumental Music with piano and the Jupiter String Quartet and Ian Hobson is going to be, in fact, Wednesday night at 7:30. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. The Chip Stevens Quartet will be at the Iron Post in Urbana tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. And it's the, I have to mention this in light of our guests here, the weekly traditional Irish music session will be at Dublin O'Neill's in downtown Champaign, as it is every Wednesday night at 8:30. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Kevin Kelly for Live and Local. Stay tuned next at 5 o'clock for All Things Considered from NPR.